20695 North Cypress Medical versus Cigna. Just hang on a second and let them kind of move from council table. Ready, counsel? All right. I think she's ready. All right, Mr. Sutter, we're ready.
Sure. May it please the court, Doug Sutter for North Cypress Medical Center. This is a case, Your Honors, wherein North Cypress brought an action on an assignment under ERISA 502A1, 502A1B, and 502A3, which included the request to recover benefits, to enforce rights, as well as to enforce injunctive relief under 502A1 and 502A3. The Lujan case is well known. There's no need to go into what that is. The law is well established. The issue is, in this particular case, Judge Ellison did a very narrow ruling with regard to Article III standing and ruled that in an ERISA case on an assignment that an injury in fact had to mean out-of-pocket damages. We had advised Judge Ellison that there are out-of-pocket damages because the...
What did you ask the lawyers? What injury did they have then?
The injury that they had, one, they purchased out-of-network benefits, they paid the prompt pay discount, and they had an interest in the heightened benefits. And just recently, the Second Circuit, but before that, the 11th Circuit has ruled that in the same situation where there is no balance billing, where there is no requirement to pay the coinsurance, that the fact that there is a request for heightened benefits, the 11th Circuit says that in and of itself is Article III standing insufficient to meet that low threshold. The Second Circuit has just ruled 3 weeks ago in the Gates case, in a very similar type case where there was a suit for heightened benefits, and there's nothing said in the Gates opinion about there being any type of balance bill or anything, but the court said that the request for the heightened benefits itself establishes Article III standing. That is all that needs to be shown.
You can show standing in a couple of ways, perhaps. One way that because they contracted through the payment of their premiums that they would be that their bills would be covered, and that did not occur, that because they received services and they were not paid for by the insurance company. They've been injured because they don't know that the hospital would take them in the future. They don't know whether the hospital will go out of business if it's having to not get paid for services that are legitimately performed. And they have a right, they have an interest in having their services paid for, don't they?
That's exactly what the 11th and the Second Circuit have said.
But then also, do you have a standing point that it's not the whole universe of the people who have the insurance that got this discounted program? There are emergency room patients and other customers of the insurance company who did not get these discounted things, and they would also have standing even for out-of-pocket because they still have bills outstanding that haven't been paid.
Correct.
Is that correct?
Yes, it is, because the prompt pay discount specifically excluded ER claims and specifically excluded any type of government claim, Medicaid.
So even if you had a really narrow view that you had to have out-of-pocket cost, those people arguably have out-of-pocket costs because those claims remain in limbo.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the other thing that I wanted to say about it is that the first case that has reviewed this, or the first court that has reviewed this very narrow holding, is Judge Solis in the Northern District back in September of 2013. And it was a very similar case, the Encompass case, because there was a prompt pay discount in that one also. And Judge Solis, Blue Cross Blue Shield, argued Judge Ellison's ruling, and Judge Solis said no, that the benefits were paid for, that there was that bargain that was struck with regard to the payment of those benefits, and that is sufficient to show Article III standing. He also said that he believed that Judge Ellison's very narrow ruling did not comport with insurance assignments and ERISA and how the entire situation happens. The Spindex case, which was just argued about 2 weeks ago, One of the issues there that the justice has brought up is the fact that there is an assignment, because that assignment does have value.
And let's assume for a moment you do have standing. Where's the breach of contract here?
Well, the obligation is, because under the ERISA, the payer, that is the third party administrator, Cigna, has to follow what the plan dictates. If there is a benefit in that plan, they have to specifically pay that benefit. And that is the agreement that is made, and that's the position, if we get past the Article III standing, as to whether or not they properly interpreted an exclusion that they used later on in this case. But that would be the breach, would be the benefits of the plan.
As I read this fact pattern, it appeared to me that you cut through all the smoke, what you end up with is that you have a hospital that wants to collect, to be generous and kind to its local patients and build a client base and tell, and then turn around and have the insurance company pay for that when they have not, in fact, incurred that cost. In other words, they were forgiving the payments. That seems to me a rather extraordinary arrangement. That's what I get from the big picture here.
Well, what Cigna claimed is that was a fee-forgiving situation. It was not, because it was a prompt pay discount. And in this particular situation...
Well, I guess I don't understand it. I mean, I don't understand how the hospital can say, no, you just pay $100, and then you turn around and bill. You didn't pay out that money, and you turn around and bill the other company for it. Now, you can go through all the mumbo-jumbo here we want to. The fact of the matter is, this just looks like a lot of paper shuffle in which money, you're collecting money you're not due. I mean, that's what it looks like, and I can, as plainly as I can put it.
Well, one, not all people paid the $100. That's what Cigna assumed by the survey that it took out of three or four people that they found. The prompt pay discount on their own survey indicated that on a number of seven or eight of them, because there's only 36 people that they based this upon, paid between $300 and $3,500.
And ERISA requires an independent evaluation of each party's claim, doesn't
Absolutely.
It? Not that, just some aggregation based upon a survey.
That's one of the arguments that we made, because under ERISA you have to have an independent review of each claim. You can't assume that every claim is going to be the same. But Judge Higginbotham, getting back to your...
Just take this. A patient walks in and he pays $100, but the services provided are $2,000. And did you, in fact, bill that back as if you had collected them? I mean, what
no,
happened?
No, under the prompt pay discount, if they paid the amount that was calculated under the prompt pay discount within the time period, then they were not going to be obligated to make any more payments. If they did not pay it, the prompt pay discount was then reversed, and then they would be obligated to make the payment. But the issue here is, when they start talking about fee forgiving, there is nothing, what we have to focus on is in the ERISA plan, that the payer has to pay exactly what the plan says. There is no prohibition for alleged fee forgiving. There is no prohibition against prompt pay discounts. And
you're forgiven, but as I understand the allegation, you aren't forgiving your own money. You're forgiving with somebody. It's what we could call OPs, that other people's money.
Well, it is the out-of-network portion, the coinsurance and the deductible is what Cigna claimed was not being paid. And in these plans, it's specifically stated in all of them that the provider may bill you for these amounts. There was no requirement in the plans that the provider bill the amount. Now, later on, you can see in the record, after we got through to the summary judgment stage,
Provider can go out, and I can open a medical office out there, and I can bill at 10% of the going rate, but you have to pay the other 90% just because I want to bill my clientele, or I'm just more forgiving and gracious, or whatever the reason, whatever my impulse is for doing so.
Well, I understand
that. This is rather a strange arrangement.
Well, I understand that, but still you have to go by what the plan says. And there was no violation of the plan with regard to the prompt pay discount or the collection of the money, because the plan did not require the provider to collect those amounts. All of these plans said the same thing. You may be billed for them.
Okay, but you were answering me by saying that's not a violation of anything. Let's see if we can establish what's the fact pattern of what you're actually... this is the deal you struck, that I can come in and I can forgive, I can charge my patients 10%, because I can be reimbursed the other 90%? Is that the deal?
The Second and 11th Circuits.
Not the legitimacy of it. Factually, is that what was going on?
No, factually what was going on is if they paid the amount, then they would assign their right to the out-of-network portion, which would be 40, 50, 60%, whatever the plan stated, and then that reimbursement would go to the provider.
Who is being reimbursed?
The third-party administrator is paying the money to the provider.
The provider that gave this 90% discount gets back that 90%. Who pays that provider?
The employees do.
Who does?
I mean, the employees do. The member pays for that because the member pays for that out of his contributions in the workplace as well as a benefit that he receives for being an employee.
But it's not a 90% discount for the whole job. It's a 90% discount of the copay or the employee's portion.
Just that, correct.
So the hypo is incorrect to say we've only been billed 10% and not the other 90%, and then we're going to go back and bill someone else for that 90%. We're talking about the copay or the insured's portion of the bill.
And the deductible, correct.
Yeah, that's all we're talking about that might be discounted. We're not talking about discounting of the entire bill for the services that were received.
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. That is correct. And the other issue is that what they attempted to do was, after the fact, they determined, before they even did an investigation, that there was what they call fee forgiving. They sent a letter out when they started this protocol about a year and 10 months later, and they did not even state what the reason was in the policy as to why they were going to reduce payments. Even if we had a $25,000 medical bill, they had decided they were going to pay $100 on every single one, on all payments, December 23, 2008.
If that was true, if your allegation is true, that would violate ERISA's requirement to do an individual analysis on each person's
claim. Full and fair
claim.
Review, correct.
Everybody gets full and fair on their claim. You can't just say for everybody you get $100. If that were in fact true, and I'm not saying that that was true, and you should have an opportunity to say it's not.
That is correct. And then after they made the statement that we determined that you are fee forgiving, they sent a letter and said we're only going to pay $100. They did not state anywhere in November 2008 letter how they arrived at that $100 figure.
Yeah, I understand what you're talking about on the copay, but that just all that's saying it's not a whole lot. I look at one. North Cypress sent Cigna a claim form listing the charge of $90,967. Under the plan, $90,000 was covered. Cigna paid $84,000, and the member should have paid $55,46, but the member paid $100. So the little discount here was over $5,000. Now, what you're talking about when you start changing the deal. If it is a change of the deal, you dramatically change the participation level of the patients themselves. That is, that a lot of insurance plans you want people to pay a copay, incur those copays, because otherwise you're going to get a lot more a lot higher level of participation. However, that's a legitimate bargaining. Now, my question is whether or not that was pursuant to the contract. You say there's no breach of the contract, that they could effectively control the level of copay that their patients were to pay.
Well, but if you go by the plan permits that. Their fee forgiving, assuming it is not illegal in the state of Texas, not illegal in ERISA. It is their business plan that they're trying to convert into a policy decision here.
So this, but it's not unusual to discount the copay portion. You know, after you go get medical treatment, usually they discount it down to one-third, even in your in-network, just to get you to pay the bill promptly. That's routine that what you pay. You call them up and you say, oh, this bill for my portion of my cancer treatment is $20,000. They say, well, if you pay us the $6,000 today, that's the whole amount. That's normal even in-network.
But who gives the discount?
The hospital.
The provider gives the discount. And that's exactly what...
And then gets reimbursed for that.
No, not for the copay portion.
No, not for that. No, the copay portion is not reimbursed by the payer. The payer only pays its portion that it contracted to pay, the X percent. That other pay, we go without, because the provider would receive that. So it's not like somebody is paying us. If we give a discount, that money, the copay, the coinsurance, it's coinsurance and deductible, would go to the provider. We are the ones that are going outside of that and not receiving that much. If we did not give the prompt pay discount, we would receive more money if the patient had paid more money. The payer does not pay that.
You're not asking the insurance company to make up the difference between what was not paid on the coinsurance.
Absolutely not.
You're only asking them to pay what their contractual portion was for the agreed upon services at the agreed upon rate.
They're 40 or 60%. Absolutely, that is the case.
All right. All right, Mr. Sutter, I believe you've reserved some rebuttal time. Ms. Bowles.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
My name is Marcia Bove, and I represent the Secretary of Labor. The assignee physicians with validly assigned benefit claims have standing to pursue them regardless of whether they have first billed their patients. We believe that the Secretary believes the District Court erred by adopting Cigna's argument that that limits injury in fact to an out-of-pocket loss. Cigna typically reimbursed the hospital from approximately $100 to $150 for assigned claims based on assumptions it made from surveys that it gave to a small number of people, approximately a little over 60, and only half of whom responded. The Secretary's view is that that violated the full and fair review requirement of Section 503 of ERISA and the Secretary's claims regulation. North Cyprus argues that Cigna's nominal reimbursements, regardless of the actual cost to the hospital, violated the plan terms applicable to the claims at issue. This is exactly the type of controversy that Section 502A1B was designed to resolve, and this dispute is sufficient to invoke, was sufficient to invoke the District Court's jurisdiction. The Secretary has no view on the competing plan interpretations of the parties, but the Secretary is here to ensure that the constitutional concept of standing is not manipulated to advantage fiduciaries to the detriment of their plan beneficiaries and ERISA's statutory enforcement scheme by allowing them to avoid resolving benefit disputes on the merits, just as Section 502A1B permits. The District Court erred because it concluded that because it limited injury in fact to an out-of-pocket loss. The injury at issue here is the failure to give participants a full and fair review as required by Section 503 of ERISA. Settled Supreme Court precedent in a wide variety of contexts where, as here, there's been an injury to federally protected rights does not limit injury in fact to an out-of-pocket financial loss. The most relevant decision is the 11th Circuit's decision in HCA, which rejected the view that providers must collect unpaid balances from their participants before they can enforce validly assigned contractual rights against a plan insurer with a contractual duty to pay for the patient's health care in accordance with the plan's terms. That circuit in Cagle pointed out that participants are better served by permitting their provider assignees to enforce the benefit claims because they're better suited, better situated, and better funded to do so. Although this circuit has not addressed the balance billing issue, it reached the same conclusion in 1988 in a case called Herman Hospital, and the 11th Circuit actually cites in Cagle Herman Hospital because although the balance billing issue has not been addressed in this circuit, the Fifth Circuit has reached the same conclusion and that is that the efficacy of plans are best protected by allowing S&E providers to enforce the contractual benefits that participants have under the plans. That permitting participants to assign their benefit claims to their providers allows ill or injured participants.
In terms of injury, what does that, the interest, the code payments themselves are largely very important because they define the risk pool. The insurers understandably would like to have the patient, the seeker of the service, to bear some portion of the expense. As you adjust those amounts upward or downward, you affect directly the insurance pool, correct or not?
Well, I don't.
What I'm getting at, this is not just a matter of moving numbers around. It affects fundamentally the insurance arrangement here, I think.
Well, the insurer has its opportunity. If the insurer thinks that this plan, that this hospital has charged a reasonable and customary rate that's too high, the insurer can deal with that when it is asked to pay its percentage of the benefits of the hospital's treatment. And that could have been dealt with when it determines, because it's the insurer that determines what reasonable and customary is. Whatever that amount is, as I understand these plans, the coinsurance, there's a percentage that should be paid by the patient, and then there's a percentage that should be paid by the insurer. And the insurer's, it's not a dollar amount, it's the reasonable and customary charge for hospitals providing the same or similar services, and that will still be determined by Cigna. Out of time, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Goldberg. As we appreciate your argument, essentially is limited to the standing issue and
yes.
Opining for a broader versus narrower determination of standing here. Is that accurate? I mean, that's the basis. Okay. All right. Thank you. We got it. All right. Mr. Simon. Or is it Simon?
Simon.
Simon. Well, you know, in this neck of the woods, there are Simons.
Mr. Chief Judge, and may it please the court, my goal is to cover at least 3 points during my time today. First, I want to tell you why the district court got the standing issue right. Second, I want to tell you why North Cypress's ERISA claims were properly dismissed, even if it did have standing. And third, I want to briefly cover, with whatever time I've got left, why we think the district court was wrong in dismissing Cigna's counterclaims as being time-barred. Let's turn.
If assume arguendo, just that we were to find that there was standing here, should we remand or should we decide the entire?
Your Honor.
Well, if we can, since we, if you'll defer for a moment.
Sure.
Since we've got this head up, whatever it takes, let's go seriatim through these before we get to this. Let's exhaust this standing piece and then go to the buddy of standing and
okay. Then. I apologize.
Just so I can keep it straight, I'll put it like that if you don't mind.
I
absolutely plan to cover why there's no need to send this court back to the district court, even if you find that they're standing, but let's start with the standing.
All right, let's
piece.
Deal with the standing.
All right.
Work our way
now, the starting point there has to be the ERISA statute itself, which does not give providers like North Cypress a cause of action. It confers standing to sue on behalf of only participants, beneficiaries, or fiduciaries, and it's well settled that a provider is none of those things. Now, admittedly, this court has resolved the question of whether a healthcare provider can have standing by virtue of assignment. That's in a long line of cases, starting with the Herman Hospital case and continuing through the Harris Methodist case.
So if the participant has standing, the hospital has standing.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. The important caveat is that when a provider sues as an assignee, they're not suing for their own injuries under the ERISA statute. Instead, they only have derivative stand. They stand in the shoes of the patient, and as this court has put it, they can assert whatever claims the patient would have, quote, no more and no less.
Weren't some of the patients here not in the either the discounted or, as you call, forgiveness program? Emergency room patients would have standing, wouldn't they?
Your Honor,
go ahead, I'm sorry.
The record shows that not a single one of North Cypress's patients was ever billed for any amounts above and beyond a discounted coinsurance amount, including their emergency room patients, including patients who didn't make the initial prompt pay payment.
If the record, in fact, showed that there are other patients whose claims remain outstanding who were billed, then you would say that as to those people, those they had standing for those.
Your Honor, the way I draw it, the way I see it, a patient would only have standing if they were able to show through concrete evidence that they will have to pay whatever portion of the bill the plan doesn't cover. Okay? Different courts have drawn that line in different places. Some courts have said a patient can meet that burden by showing that the provider has billed the patient.
Yeah, they just have to show they were billed. They don't have to show that they actually would end up paying at the end of the day. That's too high of a burden for standing.
Well, I think if you look to the Supreme Court's guidance in Lujan and most recently in Clapper, what it says is there has to be an imminent injury, or there has to be an injury that's certainly impending.
It doesn't even have to be a monetary loss, though.
It does not. We absolutely agree that the violation of a statutory right can be the basis for standing, even if there's no economic injury. But what Lujan and Clapper make clear is that that's true only if the violation of the statutory right caused some injury to the party seeking court intervention. So let's look at the facts here. How have North Cypress's patients been injured in any way?
Well, they for got, the ones that were emergency room patients, if the record shows it, they've been injured because their bills remain outstanding. But let's put those to one side, because there's a factual difference between you and me as to whether the record shows that, and I'm going to have to go look and study the record more.
And when, Your Honor, when you do that, I would ask you to look at docket entry 279, exhibit 87, which is the deposition of their 30B6 witness and business director, at pages 235, line 21 to 239. Line 15.
But even for those who were discounted, thank you for that, and I'm going to do that. For those who were discounted, they are injured if their 80% that they've paid premiums for, assuming it's a 2080, I'm just making that up, then is not paid because they've had services for which they paid premiums which are not being covered. That is an injury in fact, even if they ultimately are not billed for those, because that might make caregivers not want to do business with them if they know ahead of time that that insurance company's not going to pay their 80%.
Well, I respectfully disagree that that's an injury in fact. I think other courts have explicitly said that that hypothetical fear that a provider wouldn't provide treatment for them if they went knocked on the door later is far too remote.
Well, maybe not the fear, but the fact that they've contracted for benefits that were not paid. They did not get a benefit of their contract, regardless of whether it cost them any more money. They've already paid the money for that benefit.
All right, but let's remember, the claim here is not the value of the patient's health care plan was less than what they bargained for because claims weren't being paid. The claim here is that benefits weren't paid. And let's look at whether the fact that benefits were not paid, if we assume that they're correct and more benefits should have been paid than were paid, how has a patient been injured? Okay? The patients here got everything they cared about. They received care from North Cypress, and they paid less for it out of pocket than they should have
they
under the terms of their benefit
about
plan.
They getting the benefit of their contract, which is that I paid you to pay this bill, and you failed to do that. Regardless of whether somebody comes after me for the rest of it, I still didn't get what I bargained for.
The only interest the patients have at the time of the benefit determination, once North Cypress, and the record is crystal clear on this, North Cypress has agreed that it's never going to come after its patients for any money. beyond this discounted coinsurance amount. At that point, as soon as that deal is struck, the patient couldn't care less whether Cigna pays 100 cents on the dollar, 50.
The patient paid a premium, and it should get what it paid for. So assuming that I disagree with you on that fundamental point, then there's going to be standing, right?
If you disagree on that fundamental point.
And that's what the secretary thinks, what I'm saying right now.
Then your test is there an injury that's imminent?
All right, well, let me, I just don't want to skip here. I mean, before we get to the if there's not standing, have you exhausted fully your argument on why there isn't standing? Then we're going to get to the if there is, and then the next point.
Yeah, I think it's time to move on to even if there is standing.
I mean, you're arguing that court shouldn't be worried, neither the secretary, about a narrow definition, yada, yada. You say look hard at Lujan and Clapper, and the argument you're making is footed in those doctrines, notwithstanding whatever the scenario. I mean, that's your bottom line. Is that right?
Bottom line is the patients have been injured, therefore North Cyprus standing in their shoes doesn't have standing.
You accept there could be derivative standing if there's some benefit, but you say patient got all they bargained for in terms of health care, what they paid, et cetera. You say even in a broader definition, there's no standing. Is that right?
That's exactly right, Your Honor.
All right. And you, I mean, that the full measure?
Yeah, I think what we should do is turn to the merits.
All right.
Because
I don't want to keep coming back. I want to make sure I got it down pat here on the standing before we go off in the other race. We may decide we don't have to reach it, but I want to make sure I got everybody in the tape.
I'm happy to answer any other questions anyone has about standing, but otherwise.
Right. I think we're good. I mean, the secretary is here, you know, with the representative on the standing issue, presumably because of policies. All right, now let's move from that, assuming ergo, to the next one. Take him there, Judge Elrod, if you want to take
him. You go ahead.
Thank you. Even if North Cyprus has standing, the dismissal of its ERISA claims should still be affirmed because the district court has already reached the merits on the ERISA claim and correctly concluded that Cigna did not abuse its discretion in denying benefits. Less than 2 months after the district court dismissed the ERISA claim for lack of standing, it issued the second decision, that's the August 10th decision, showing that even if North Cyprus had standing, its ERISA claim would still fail as a matter of law on the merits. Now, to determine whether, admittedly, that was a decision that dealt with a breach of contract claims that were still in the case after the standing decision, but to determine whether Cigna breached the contracts, what's critical here is that the district court has already conducted the exact same analysis that would need to conduct to determine whether North Cyprus's ERISA claims survived on the merits. Judge Ellison applied the exact same ERISA abuse of discretion standard that would need to be applied to the exact same ERISA plan terms that would be at issue to the exact same evidence from the ERISA administrative record. And if you look at the August 10th opinion, it's clear that not only did North Cyprus not have standing, but its claims would still fail on the merits even if it did have standing. Now,
is it true that Cigna said $100 per claim, even for claims for which North Cyprus did not apply any discount?
No, that is not true, Your Honor. What happened here was Cigna learned through an investigation that North Cyprus never, not for a single patient, charged the proper coinsurance under the terms of its plans.
So you can't say never based upon the investigation, so where do you get the never?
Well, that's been confirmed in discovery in this case, but Cigna called North Cyprus. North Cyprus had flyers out there, one of them is in our Cigna record excerpts tabs, tab 2, saying, come to us because we'll charge you as if you went to an in-network hospital, even though we're an out-of-network hospital that charges 4 to 6 times Medicare rates. There was no secret about what North Cyprus was doing towards the end of Cigna's investigation. Okay, so Cigna knew that North Cyprus was not holding its patients legally responsible or responsible in any way for the charges that it was submitting to Cigna. What is Cigna to do at that point? Cigna, remember, has fiduciary duties not just to the patients. Cigna has fiduciary duties to the plan, other plan members, and the plan sponsor to pay claims correctly.
So did it pay $100 per claim?
What Cigna did was it wrote a letter to North Cyprus, and this is in Cigna record excerpt tabs 4 and 5. It said, we know you're not collecting coinsurance you're required. We did a survey. The best we could come up with is that for every, you're generally charging $100 or less. Going forward, you need to tell us how much you're charging the patient, or we'll have no choice but to apply the assumption that you're charging $100 per claim.
So they did $100. Cigna used $100.
That's correct.
Which is my original question. They paid $100 per claim.
They paid as if the coinsurance charge was $100 per claim. So if the member, for example, had a plan that was a 80-20 plan, meaning... Okay.
They paid as if the coinsurance was $100, even though ERISA statutorily requires for individualized analysis and payment of each claim.
There was individualized analysis on the payment for each claim. The analysis was, the administrative record for each claim, was that North Cyprus does not collect the coinsurance obligated under the terms of Cigna's plans.
What consequence is that to your client?
That has a huge consequence to my client,
please,
Your Honor.
Please explain that.
Sure. North Cyprus contends somehow that the payment of coinsurance is optional under the terms of Cigna's plans, that it can charge whatever it wants to Cigna, regardless of how much coinsurance it collects. That is simply false. Coinsurance is a requirement under Cigna's plans. If you look at Exhibit 4, Docket Entry 268, there's an example of a Cigna plan. The coinsurance requirement has to be mandatory because it's the critical way in which health plans control costs by encouraging patients to see low-priced in-network providers as opposed to high-priced out-of-network providers. It's also a critical constraint on the North Cypruses of the world's ability to charge exorbitant rates for their services. Because if a member goes to a hospital that charges $500,000 for a surgery, as North Cyprus did, they're probably not going to go to that hospital if they're forced to pay 20% of that exorbitant charge.
So right, but also, your brief says that they were charged enormous and unjustified costs. If that were the case, then you negotiate with the provider and you say that's not reasonable and customary, and that happens all the time between hospitals and insurance companies. So if it really was enormous and unjustified, then you have a remedy built into ERISA that is the normal remedy that you use all the time when you think a rate is unfair. And you can say, we reject that. We only pay the in-network rate regardless of what you pay. And that's very common. So you're not, this parade of horribles is not going to manifest itself because you're still going to be able to say that's not reasonable and customary.
Two responses, Your Honor. Could
you complete your answer to my question, please? That's all I really want to know. If you explain that, I understand my colleague's argument. I'd like to hear yours.
Yeah, I think what's really key and what I would recommend to the panel is you should read Judge Easterbrook's decision in the Kennedy case from the Seventh Circuit, which explains all of the important reasons why coinsurance has to be collected. I think if you look at what really happened here is you've got a provider who's saying, we're going to take what we get from the insurance company. You're off the hook, patient. And what Judge Easterbrook said in the Kennedy case, I'll read a quote, by promising that the provider would look exclusively to Cigna for payment, the provider relieved the patient of any obligation to pay. So the provider's charge to the patient was zero, and 80% of nothing is nothing. And that's exactly what happened here. Now, Judge Elrod was pointing to another part of Cigna's plans that potentially could limit Cigna's exposure to the North Cypruses of the world. As a matter of fact, Your Honor, Cigna ended up paying millions and millions and millions of dollars to North Cyprus before it figured out what was going on here. So that plan provision didn't protect Cigna. But there's another critical plan provision that I think you all need to be aware of. It's the one that Judge Ellison based his decision that Cigna didn't abuse its discretion on. It's the one that says, covered expenses will not include and no payment will be made for charges for which you are not obligated to pay or for which you are not billed. Okay? There's no dispute in this case on the facts that North Cyprus's patients were not obligated to pay its charges. Cigna's interpretation of that provision was legally correct. And Cigna's application of the evidence was also correct and within the zone of reasonableness that this court requires under where a plan gives an administrator discretion.
But this is like a paid or incurred provision. You know, like Texas law has paid or, you may not know.
Texas law has paid or incurred.
And if incurred is different than paid. And so the second portion of your contract arrangement says for which you were billed. And what you've been billed is what you've incurred. Even if you don't, or is not paid. It's two separate provisions. It's an or for which you have been billed.
Your Honor, that provision is critical and it exists to prevent the North Cypress of the world from doing what they're doing.
Aren't they billed? The patient is billed.
They are not, Your Honor. The record evidence, and I think you need to look at, Docket entry 316, exhibit 120, at page 576 to 577, again, this is the Ms. Tankersley, the business director of North Cypress, their 30B6 witness. Question, and in signing up for the prompt pay discount, North Cypress agrees that they, the patients, are not required anything more to pay anything more than a discounted amount if they pay within a certain period of time. Is that correct? Yes. That's what happened here.
But that doesn't impact the billed portion. Remember that phrase you just read to us says billed or billed.
The total charges to the patient, they've never seen. They never received a bill from North Cypress that said pay $500,000 for a surgery. They were billed $100.
Right. They were sent a bill that said, and maybe you could tell me that this is not what the bill said, but I thought the bill says your co-insurance amount is $20,000, but if you pay promptly, you pay $100.
No.
Or you pay $50, whatever that. It's a lower amount, but they are told that if they don't pay promptly, it's another amount. Is that not in
that the is record? Not correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
What happened was.
Well, then where can I look at some bills so I can go through that very carefully?
What happened was, Your Honor, when a patient came in to North Cypress, they went and filled out a worksheet. I don't have the citation handy, but it's in our briefs. They filled out a worksheet that said, here's the CPT codes that we're going to bill, which is the procedure codes. Here's what 125% of the Medicare allowable amount is for that service. You pay us that. You pay us nothing more. That's all we're going to collect from you. Then North Cypress send the bill to Cigna, not for 125% of the Medicare amount, for North Cypress's rack rates, 4 to 6 times Medicare rates. The patient has never seen those charges. They don't know what those charges are, and they're not obligated to pay them. They were never obligated to pay them. Every North Cypress witness, from its CEO on down, testified that the patient, if they paid that discounted 125% of Medicare rate, that's all they ever had to pay. So the charges that North Cypress submitted to Cigna weren't actual charges. They were a pure legal fiction. As Judge Easterbrook put it in the Kennedy case, they were phantom charges. Those are exactly the charges that Cigna's plans in saying we're not going to pay charges that you're not obligated to pay or that you're not billed for are supposed to be excluded. Because again, if North Cypress isn't charging the coinsurance it's supposed to, that fundamentally affects the entire actuarial basis for health plans in this country. And I encourage the panel to reconsider the Kennedy opinion and right. The SmileCare opinion from the Ninth Circuit.
All right, hang on, Mr. Simon. my notes showed, you told me you had 3 points to make. I think we went through 1 and 2. We asked you a lot of questions. I'm going to give you 2 minutes on the clock to make your third points, and I'll give Mr. Sutter 2 minutes on his rebuttal additional to make sure we've covered the waterfront here.
Thank you very much.
You got me? So this is to your third point, so we're
yes,
clear
Honor.
On that. All right.
All right. Because North Cypress filed multiple rounds of amended complaints in this case, which required multiple rounds of motion to dismiss briefing, Cigna's answer and counterclaims were not due under the federal rules until more than 2.5 years into this litigation. And that's when Cigna filed them. Now, the law in this circuit is crystal clear that the statute of limitations for compulsory counterclaims based on recoupment theories is told from the date that the plaintiff files its complaint. That's crystal clear. What's not clear is whether the statute of limitations for compulsory counterclaims is similarly told for compulsory counterclaims that seek affirmative relief, like the claims that Cigna is asserting.
What relief do you seek by your counterclaim?
We seek recovery of the overpayments that Cigna made to North Cyprus pursuant to ERISA 502A3.
And the overpayment is what?
The overpayment is the fact that North Cyprus misrepresented its actual charges in the claims forms it sent to us. Cigna, therefore, paid more than it should have under the plan term that says it's only responsible for charges that the patient is legally obligated to pay.
How much is it?
I think it's in the $15 to $20 million range of what was overpaid.
Why do you ask for a reimbursement for it and you don't know exactly how much it is?
I believe the calculation, I believe, is $15 to $20 million. I could be mistaken.
Would you need to remand if we were going to rule for you on that claim to be for calculations and that sort of thing?
Well, there was no trial on Cigna's counterclaims.
Right, and so we would need.
Yeah, I think absolutely. If Cigna's counterclaims are reinstated, this has to go back down to the district court.
But you would say when we look at the record, you have adequately teed it up, so to speak, as a legal premise. If we were to get to that point,
yes, Your Honor,
that can be dealt with.
Yes, Your Honor. And we think the majority rule, according to Wright and Miller, the majority rule is that the statute of limitations for all counterclaims is told, all compulsory counterclaims, is told from the date of the filing of the plaintiff's complaint. We think that rule makes a lot of sense because if defendants are forced to file their counterclaims before they know whether their motion to dismiss can be granted, what the district court judges in this circuit are going to get is a whole lot more counterclaims than they otherwise would have.
All right, Mr. Simon, I've let you make the point. I'll cut you off on elaboration. So we at least know what your third point that was about the counterclaims in, and it's fairly before us. And we'll hear back now from Mr. Sutter. And
thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Sutter, Your Honor. You'll have the additional couple of minutes to be able to cover anything you want to cover in the time.
Sure. Let me tell you how the court got to what the people say the merits of the case are. The judge initially ruled 12B that with regard to the repricing agreements, that after they knew about the prompt pay discount, they came in and repriced with us and entered into contracts. He said, we can determine those contracts without looking at the plan, so he didn't grant their 12B. Then when he decided there was no Rule 11 or Article 3 standing, he comes in and says, well, Texas law is going to apply to the repriced agreements. Then he looks at the repriced agreements and he goes to ERISA law, to the deference law, to determine whether or not there's arbitrary and capricious. Then when there's an issue about whether or not they're waiver, he jumps out of the ERISA law and goes back to Texas law and says there's no waiver in the situation. And what the court did not consider is that the evidence in this case is that when Cigna came in and created savings, that is, paid less than whatever the allowed amount was, they participated in those savings up to 29%. That means they took that money and they put it in their pockets. That is a conflict of interest. And what we got from the district court at that time, we believed we were going to receive a decision on the repricing agreements pursuant to Texas law. He comes in and surprises everybody, at least of all Cigna, and rules on an ERISA basis. And we told him at that time, on the motion to reconsider and also in our motion, that there is a conflict of interest. You have to follow the Shebeck's neighbor case, I'm always mispronounced that, in the Fifth Circuit, that says that when you have a conflict of interest, the district court is required to weigh that conflict. It is still a deference. It is still arbitrary and capricious. The Supreme Court that made that clear in the Glenn case, but you have to consider it. And in this case, the only evidence was the same people who made the determination of what the claims were talking all along, how much money can we save if we pay nothing, if we pay $100. Their general counsel, who I deposed up in Hartford, testified that she said it smacks of a genuine effort to review these claims if we pay zero. So that's when they came up with the $100 claim. They wrote us a letter in November and told us that they were going to pay $100 per claim. At no time did they ever say, here is an exclusion, charges for which you're not obligated to pay or would not otherwise be billed.
Okay. And I have a question about the facts. Do you have in this record any bills that show that the patient was billed for its co-insurance amount? Or do you not have that?
No, the patient would receive the EOB, explanation of benefits, that would come from the payer that would indicate what the patient amount was.
And would it be $100 always, or would it be the actual?
No, it would show. It would show the amount of what the copay was.
And is it your position that the EOB satisfies as a bill under your contract with Cigna?
Well, sure, it would go to them. Because at the end
But you've got to have a bill so that you can get out of your contractual problem. It has to be either paid or billed.
Well, if Article 3 is limited to only a balanced bill on it, which it is not, because they're still entitled to the benefits, the Second Circuit and the 11th Circuit.
I'm not talking about standing. I'm talking about the merits on the contract claim. We're not talking about standing. Your opposing counsel says that I was wrong, and I respect that I may be wrong, and that there is not a bill in this record that the patient was billed the co-insurance amount.
No, what the patient would be billed is when they did the prompt pay discount and we did the Access NCMC form with them, we advised them at that time, this is the amount that you must pay. If they paid that amount at that time or within 120 days, then they were not billed anything further. If they did not pay that amount, that was reversed and they were billed.
Were they billed later than the other amount?
They were billed if they did not pay the prompt pay discount.
Are those in the record?
Yes.
Any of those bills where they were billed non-prompt pay?
It would probably come through the testimony of Ms. Tankersley.
Okay, because you need those in the record to show what the real bills are. And if you do have those, that defeats the standing and the contract claim, and your opposing counsel realizes that.
Yes, but
so Tankersley's deposition is going to have these bills.
Where she testified that they would be billed if they did not pay the prompt pay amounts.
Okay.
Correct.
Do you have in the record that emergency room patients were not given this prompt pay discount?
Yes.
Is that really in the record? The opposing counsel says it's not.
Yes, it was. It would be in the testimony of the 30B6 representatives as well as Ms. Tankersley, that the ER people were obligated to pay and the prompt pay discount did not apply to those people.
Maybe I'm not hearing well, and that could be because my ears are still stopped up from flying, but I still don't hear you answering that this bill in this record. I hear you talking about what Ms. Tankersley said. I hear you talking about the 30B6 witness, what somebody might have, what ought to happen, et cetera. But here you have adroitly responded, but not succinctly answered that, in fact, when we look in his record, there's a paper there that shows the bill. I get my share of explanation of benefits on my personal claims, and I sure don't look at it as any kind of bill. It's just explaining what the benefits are, the categories, et cetera. When I get a bill, I then know to pull out my checkbook, and I don't pull it out until that happens. So I'm trying to fit it within the real world of what you're describing here. What are their bills, you know, actually that are in the record versus testimony about what the scenario typically is?
That information would be in the spreadsheets that were provided to Cigna when we provided each patient's name and each patient if they were balanced billed. That would be the evidence of which ones would receive the bill. You'd have to look at the spreadsheet.
Would that be there in connection with, as you're saying, the testimony of, you know, the 36 witness or Ms. Tanks? In other words, a document or documents that's aiding, you know, this testimony
I don't recall if they pulled out the spreadsheet and showed it to Ms. Tankersley or not, but it was clearly produced and clearly mentioned in the record. With regard to the merits, then, is that the last point that I wanted to make is that the factor of the conflict of interest was never taken into consideration by the court, and I believe that the court was required to do that, and he ignored it. He mentioned it when he began the analysis, and then as you walk through it, the analysis never has anything at all about the conflict that is required.
One quick question about if you were correct with regard to your Article 3 argument, the Article 3 argument here, what effect does that have on the counterclaim if we should find that it is still viable?
Okay. Well, the effect on the counterclaim is that the fraud that they claimed was that we didn't put in whatever the prompt pay discount is in box number 47 of the UB04. And in box number 47, we put in total charges, which is required by Cigna's instructions to us, written instructions that is in the record, and the CMS's instructions, because this is a CMS form. We are required to sum total everything. And the fact of the matter is...
what I'm saying is that that counterclaim appears to me has not been developed. It's not clear to me if their tolling argument is good. We have an outstanding counterclaim, and I take it there's an independent basis of jurisdiction for it. And why can't they proceed on the counterclaim?
Well, on that would be the case. But the fact of the matter is, on the statute of limitations that apply, is their only causes of action that remain, because everything else was preempted, was 5013A, which is for unjust enrichment. And there is no doubt whatsoever that unjust enrichment is a two-year statute.
What did the trial court, what was the basis of the trial court's ruling?
That was the basis of the trial court's ruling, that it was a two-year statute, because they knew from day one about the prompt pay discount. They wrote...
I thought he ruled on limitations. I didn't hear you.
No, it was limitations, okay. Two-year statute.
If we disagree with him on limitations, you've just got to go forward on your counterclaim.
That would be the case.
Sure.
That would be the case. But then what the court will have to look at is what they're claiming on their counterclaim. They're claiming fraud because we didn't write $100 in the total charges, for which that first year and 10 months when they were cooking up their protocol and how they were going to handle this situation and debating should we pay zero or nothing, they continued to pay knowing exactly. And they had the right at every time under UCR, they had the sole discretion to determine not to pay whatever they wanted to pay on these bills.
All right, counsel, thank all counsel in the case. It's as interesting as an ERISA case can be. With that, the case will be submitted. Before we take up the third case, the panel will stand in a real short recess.